number 3084010, Kathleen Swierwatka versus Rockwell Automation.
Good morning. May it please the court. I'm Bob Duffy, and along with Autumn Cruz, I am pleased to represent Rockwell Automation in this case. We also represented Rockwell before the jury trial before Judge Adelman and are happy to be here before this court.
Thank you.
The issue that we believe is before this court today is whether Rockwell should have been denied judgment under the ADA and required to pay any attorney's fees in a case in which the jury concluded that even if Rockwell had not misunderstood Ms. Swierwatka, the plaintiff's standing or walking limitations, it still would have released her from her employment. Because we believe that there are three main reasons that the court should not have denied Rockwell judgment and should not have required Rockwell to pay any fees, we are asking for a reversal of the court's decision on that issue. There are three particular issues I'd like to raise with the court with its permission today. The first relates
to... one question to start in that.
Yes.
This is a mixed motive case, isn't it?
Well, that's the first question, isn't it, Your Honor? I mean, I don't think that it's conceded that it's a mixed motive case. Interestingly, Rockwell presented, as did the plaintiff presented, jury instructions in a special verdict form that arguably were under the Seventh Circuit model rules for a disparate treatment case, not a mixed motive case.
Well, but, I mean, I took your point in the briefs that the jury was not given a mixed instruction. But the jury's answer to question number three, the special verdict form, well, boy, that looks very much like a mixed motive finding. Moreover, I also took a look at the, your response to the plaintiff's request for judgment, and nowhere there do you dispute the notion that this was a mixed motive verdict. So don't we have to start from the premise here that this was a mixed motives finding?
Your Honor, I think that Rockwell moved for judgment at the close of the case, and I don't believe that we waived any issue as it relates to whether this was a mixed motive case, but we are prepared to argue it as a mixed motive case. We just point out for the court that, in fact, Rockwell did not submit it as a mixed motive case, nor did the plaintiff.
Well, Rockwell, not Rockwell, but the plaintiff, I think somehow that question number three got into the verdict form.
Yes.
Whether it was submitted by either party, that the court submitted it.
That's correct.
And that's where I think we're talking about, is once you have the answer to question three, don't you have a mixed motive case?
Yeah. And, Your Honor, again, I think I've tried to make the point, which is simply that we never conceded that it was a mixed motive case. For the purposes of our argument, we're pleased to, for the Seventh Circuit to analyze the law as it applies to a mixed motive case and believe that in that case, Rockwell still must be granted judgment and no attorney's fees may be awarded. As it relates to the issue of the what is the applicable statute for the purposes of attorney's fees, it's Rockwell's position that the ADA's specific attorney's fees provision, which is section 122.05, is the only one that should and can be applied to this case. An argument is for a number of reasons. First, because in the ADA itself, the only specific provision that provides for attorney's fees is 122.05. When the ADA,
forgive me, but I've got to get this clear in my own mind, because this is a close case. When the parties briefed the plaintiff's request for declaratory and injunctive relief and fees, you did not contest that this was a mixed motive finding, correct? It's a yes or no. It's a yes or no.
Your Honor, I'm sorry. I believe in the brief itself we did not, in response to their motion. I believe in our brief in support of our motion for judgment, we discussed the case in the context of a disparate treatment case. I'm sorry, Your Honor, I don't know the answer on that issue.
Because, of course, if we accept the jury's answer to question number three as a mixed mode of finding, then pursuant to 42 117A, the court was authorized to award plaintiff declaratory and injunctive relief along with the attorney's fees.
Well, and that's the part that we disagree with, Your Honor. I don't think that that's a fair reading of the ADA, nor should it be the applicable provision in this case. There is only one Court of Appeals decision that has looked at the issue of whether or not 12205, the specific attorney's fees provision under the ADA, or 12217, the general provision that applies to a panoply of remedies and procedures available under Title VII, should apply. And that circuit court decision, which is Pedigo, the Eighth Circuit, the court held that, in fact, in an ADA case, in a mixed mode of ADA case, the appropriate inquiry is under 12205, not under 12117.
Well, the fact that the ADA also contains a separate provision for an award of attorney's fees to a prevailing party shouldn't undermine the conclusion that Section 12117 provides for the same relief that Title VII authorizes.
I'd have to disagree pretty strongly with that, because if you look at 12205 as well as the legislative history to the ADA, at the time the ADA was enacted, the legislative history made clear that its attorney's fees provision should be applied under the Federal Civil Rights Attorney's Fees Statute, which looked to prevailing party under FAR of the Supreme Court's decision. At the time that the ADA was enacted, the mixed motive remedy under Title VII wasn't even in place.
Well, it seems to me that Section 12117A applies when a jury is rendered a mixed motive, whereas 12205 applies in the usual case. That's the way I, you know.
Well, again, Your Honor, the Seventh Circuit has not yet decided the issue. The Eighth Circuit's the only. So lucky you, hasn't yet decided the issue. The Eighth Circuit is the only one that has. It's decided it the other way. It's finding that 12205 applies. And I think it makes sense for 12205 to apply for a number of reasons. First of all, is if you look at the differences between Title VII and the ADA, under the ADA, an employer is required to consider an individual's disability, is required to look at their work restrictions, is required to have an interactive process with the employee as to what those restrictions are, to understand them, to help them work on accommodations, to decide whether or not there are reasonable jobs that might be available for the individual to perform with those particular restrictions. That's exactly what Rockwell did here. It was supposed to consider the plaintiff's disability, which it did. And under Title VII, you're never allowed to consider protected status under that law, except in very limited circumstances, which aren't even close here. And it's clear, even if you look at, Your Honor, if you want to look at 12117, it refers back to the powers, remedies, and procedures under Title VII, a whole panoply of them, including under 2000E5. But if you go to 2000E5 under Title VII, it makes it clear that even under the mixed motive provision that was added after the ADA was enacted, the attorney's fees are only to be provided if, in fact, you can prove a claim under 2000E2M, which says it has to be for those particular factors under Title VII. Sex, race, national origin, nothing about disability. And again, it makes sense from a public policy perspective that the court would say that the legislature amended Title VII because they were concerned about the Supreme Court's decision in Price Waterhouse that said even in Title VII cases where an employer impermissibly considers certain factors like race, sex, that in those cases the Supreme Court had held that there was no remedy for the plaintiff. And the legislature amended Price Waterhouse to provide that there would be, because they're saying that you should never consider those factors under Title VII. Well, under the ADA, you're supposed to consider those factors. And so it makes no sense to go to 12117 for the purposes of a mixed motive analysis under the ADA. A plaintiff in an ADA case should get fees and appropriate remedies in a mixed motive case where it can in fact establish that regardless of whether or not the employer improperly considered the disability, the individual still would have been fired even though there were other reasons out there for the termination. It's also true that apart from the court's decision in Pedigo, the Seventh Circuit has, in any cases that it's looked at what is the proper attorney's fees provision under the ADA, has always analyzed those cases under 12205. Again, no Seventh Circuit case that tells us what to do in a mixed motive case.
Well, in my simplistic view of life at this point, Section 12117A cross-references the mixed motive provision of Title VII, 42 2000E(b)(i), which authorizes such relief.
Well,
Judge Edelman concluded that this provision thus provides for the same relief that Title VII authorizes. But, of course, you know, go back and try and recreate morass.
Well, Your Honor, just maybe a correction. The ADA does not specifically reference the mixed motive provision in Title VII. The ADA...
Well, it contains a separate provision.
The ADA, the provision that the plaintiff is trying to rely on and that Judge Edelman relied on was 12117. That specifically references a whole panoply of provisions under Title VII, which includes 2000E5. 2000E5 includes multiple procedures and remedies under Title VII. One of those, which is 2000E5, sub G, sub 2, sub B, is the mixed motive provision. That wasn't even added until after the ADA was enacted.
You forgot little I.
I'm sorry. Thank you. Yes, you're right. I. That's correct. Right. So it's Rockwell's position that
save time for your rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. I believe I still have two more minutes before I go for rebuttal. I think
No. Your white light's on.
White light's on, so that means that I'll
save
my time.
Yeah.
All right. I'll save my time then. Thank you.
Okay. Mr. Scott?
Y'all?
Good morning.
May it please the Court. My name is Kevin Scott, and I, along with Attorney Robert Milek, represented the plaintiff appellee in this case, Kathleen Sawatka. This case, to us, presents a very straightforward analysis. In that 42 U.S.C. 117...
Sure.
42 U.S.C. 117 specifically incorporates all of the remedies of Title VII. Therefore, the judge had the power to grant the remedies he did in this case. The standard of review for his granting of these remedies is an abuse of discretion, and we believe the judge did not abuse his discretion in this case. First, the plain and ordinary meaning of 42.117 is that all of the remedies of Title VII are incorporated. This includes, of course, the mixed motives provision of 2000E2M. It's unnecessary for us to even look at the legislative history behind this because the plain and ordinary meaning is right there on its face. There's been much ado about legislative history and whether the ADA was meant to incorporate this or whether Title VII was meant to also apply to or the mixed motive provision of Title VII was meant to apply to ADA cases. However, it's unnecessary to even get to that.
If this was a mixed motives case, why wasn't the jury given a mixed motives instruction? The instruction that the jury was given was a disparate treatment instruction, not a mixed motive instruction. And if you view this as a mixed motives case, I'm a bit surprised that you didn't ask for the standard mixed motive instruction that says, once the plaintiff succeeds in proving that a forbidden factor contributed to the employer's decision, the burden shifts to the employer to show that it would have taken the same action regardless of the forbidden motive. I mean, did counsel in the court ever discuss whether to give a mixed motive instruction?
As far as I can remember, the discussions in chambers, I don't remember that specific issue coming up. However, if you look at the verdict form, the fourth question asks, would they have terminated Kathleen Sawatka's employment even if they did not perceive her to be disabled, even if everything else had remained the same. If you look at the standard instruction or 4.02, the fourth question states, defendant would not have taken the adverse employment action if plaintiff had not had a disability, but everything else had remained the same. So in essence, it is a mixed motive instruction, because if you look at the comment D for mixed motive, you'll find that you're asked to replace question 4 with, if you find the plaintiff has proved that a disability contributed to the defendant's decision, you must then decide whether the defendant proved by a preponderance of the evidence that it would have taken the adverse action even if the plaintiff did not have a disability. So in essence, it was a mixed motive instruction. And
what's the verdict form is a mixed motive instruction, you're saying?
Correct.
It wasn't a mixed motive instruction.
Oh,
stand alone.
I'm sorry.
There was not a mixed motive instruction given standing alone. It's through the questions of the verdict form that you come up with the mixed motive verdict. Is that correct? You argue mixed motive to the jury?
We never argued mixed motive. That's an affirmative defense. It was our burden to prove that there was discrimination, that there was a violation of the ADA. And we presented evidence to rebut their position that they terminated Kathleen Sirwacket for a legitimate reason. We never actually argued that it was a mixed motive claim. That would have been their burden to carry.
Did anybody argue it? Up until the time you got to the verdict form and the special verdict form assigned answered the way it was. Did anybody up to that point say on this verdict form you need to answer yes, 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 yes down the line? And I assume defense position would have been, or appellant's position would have been, answered no, no, no. At what point did this come into play except after the verdict after jury returning verdict?
I think it just came into play with the evidence that was presented. As the trial went along and the evidence was presented, it became clear what the issues of the case were, which were, we believe that there was a violation of the ADA, but they believe that they terminated her for a legitimate reason. And that's a mixed motive case. It evolved into that. It wasn't necessarily a mixed motives claim. And as far as whether or not it's if a disparate treatment cannot be a mixed motives claim, that I don't believe that that would be correct. If you look at the pattern jury instructions, the normal, it's for a disparate treatment claim. But then if there is evidence of mixed motives, you may change the fourth element. So first off, the plain and ordinary meaning of 12.117, we believe, grants the court the power. Second off, if to hold otherwise would violate canon of statutory construction, that no provision may be read in a way that renders it meaningless. And if you adopt Rockwell's reading of 42.117, it would render at least in part meaningless. And that they're saying that although the statute incorporates, it tries to incorporate all the Title VII's remedies, although it incorporates all of Title VII's remedies, because the particular remedy that we are trying to apply does not mention disability, therefore it does not apply.
You have a mixed motive here.
Right, exactly. Sorry.
Would you like a glass of water?
That'd be unnecessary, thanks. Thank you very much, Your Honor. Rockwell's position is that for a Title VII remedy to be incorporated in the ADA, the Title VII provision must mention disability. But none of them do under Title VII. Title VII does not mention disability anywhere in its remedies. The ADA does. And to say that in order to incorporate a Title VII remedy through 12.117, it must mention disability would then render 12.117 meaningless, because you would be incorporating no remedies at that point. Furthermore, it's our position the judge did not abuse his discretion in awarding Sirwacket remedies pursuant to 2000E5. It was clear that he had properly applied the Akrabawi factors. Akrabawi sets the standard. This is a case authored by you, Judge Evans. And he clearly considered the factors outlined in that case. The factors are the reasons why injunctive relief was or was not granted, or the extent and nature of the injunctive relief. Now, although the Rockwell makes an issue of that he did not examine closely enough the reasons for his granting of injunctive relief, at the same time, he did examine the extent and nature of an injunctive relief. In his in the decision, he mentions that there was a minimal tangible relief, non-monetary relief, excuse me. There's a general proportionality factor. Was the public purpose served? The judge addressed this by reducing the amount of fees by 80%. The extent to which the employees, and the third factor is the extent to which the employee's misconduct and not the employer's discrimination drove the employment decision. This was a balancing test that he employed to show that the plaintiff did not commit any misconduct and there was a discriminatory motive on the part of Rockwell. Although he did find there was no widespread or intolerable animus, that is not the same as a discriminatory motive. That the widespread or intolerable animus would go towards the depth of the discriminatory motive as opposed to whether or not one existed or not. And furthermore, the Shepherd factors and the Akrabawi factors are merely a good starting point. As the Ninth Circuit pointed out in Norris versus Cisco, a court need not necessarily apply all of the Shepherd factors in exercising discretion. It also may, or it may consider other relevant factors. The court properly considered the factors at play in this case. The public purpose was served by proving a discrimination case. Contrary to Rockwell's position, merely bringing a case does nothing, as an innocent defendant needs no discouraging. Rockwell did act out of a discriminatory motive, and Sirwacka committed no misconduct. Sirwacka obtained some non-monetary relief, and the judge reduced the overall fees by 80%. At this point, I'd like to address some of the arguments that they make in their reply brief. The jury did not reach a defense verdict in this case. It reached a mixed motives verdict. Disparate treatment claims can be analyzed under a mixed motives analysis. Their claim that disparate treatment claims are somehow disparate from mixed motives claims is baseless. The Supreme Court case Desert Palace versus Costa is an example of a disparate treatment claim wherein their employer had mixed motives. The pattern jury instructions also recognize that an employer may have mixed motives in a disparate treatment case and provide an instruction based on those facts. And the district court did not err as a matter of law when it granted injunctive and declaratory relief. Rockwell has failed to explain how no reasonable person could come to the conclusion that the declaratory relief should be awarded, that the declaratory relief awarded, signifying Sirwacka was terminated in violation of the ADA, was unreasonable. Same for the injunctive relief awarded. By requiring insertion of the judgment into Sirwacka's employment file, it ensures that future employers who inquire as to her work history will receive the full story of her termination from Rockwell. Rockwell has also failed to explain how no reasonable mind could come to that conclusion. If they have a difference of opinion, it's irrelevant. If reasonable minds could differ, there is no abuse of discretion. Just because she does not work there anymore does not mean that there is no benefit. Almost all of the plaintiffs who would seek this type of relief under the ADA or Title VII don't work for their former employers. It's generally why they're suing them. The court did not err in awarding a portion of Sirwacka's attorney's fees. Rockwell never explains how the language of 42 U.S.C. 117 is ambiguous, and therefore there must be an analysis of legislative history. Title VII does not mention the ADA. Why would it? Title VII is a separate scheme. The ADA incorporates the remedies of Title VII. By its plain language, 42 U.S.C. 2000E2M does not mention disability, but the ADA does, and it incorporates all the remedies of Title VII. Thank you. I think that's all I have.
I think you did the right thing by not cross-appealing.
Sorry?
I want to compliment you for not having cross-appealed the significant reduction in attorney's fees here.
Thank you very much.
A couple of things. Your Honor, you asked me about whether we raised the mixed motive issue before the trial court below. At the point post-verdict was when both parties moved for judgment. At that time, we did not specifically say this was not a mixed motive case. Instead, we argued that that Rockwell was entitled to judgment and no fees because we were the prevailing party and because Mr. Watka was not. Really, as you pointed out, this issue came up post-verdict for the first time as far as whether this was a mixed motive case or not. We presented it without a mixed motive case, and so did the plaintiff and so did the court.
But am I correct if I think that when the parties briefed the plaintiff's request for declaratory and injunctive relief and fees, that you did not contest that this was a mixed motive finding?
It is correct, Your Honor, that we did not specifically say this was not a mixed motive finding. We argued that the plaintiff was not a prevailing party.
So you've waived any contention, have you not?
I don't believe so, Your Honor, because we were arguing all along for the prevailing party provision under 12205. But that's Rockwell's position in it, Your Honor. A couple of things. The plaintiff has said repeatedly that if you don't apply the mixed motive provision under Title VII, you render 12217 meaningless. That's not true. 12217 provides multiple remedies and procedures under Title VII. The mixed motive provision only came in after the AEA was enacted. It does not render meaningless 12217. Finally, even under a mixed motive analysis, Akrabawi and the court's decision in Edwards v. Rosewood in Northern District of Illinois confirm that Rockwell should not be required to provide any fees in this case. Balancing those things, it's clear that there was a limited public purpose behind this particular case. This was a single case of discrimination. There was no company-wide policy that was applied in a way that was discriminatory. There was no evidence of widespread animus. Indeed, Judge Adelman specifically found that there was no animus at all rendered toward this plaintiff. And further, the employer had legitimate reasons for what it did. In fact, what's happening here, if Rockwell is required to pay fees, is we're being punished for doing what we're supposed to do under the ADA, which is try to understand what an individual's restrictions are and make decisions about that. That's what Rockwell did in this case. We should not be punished simply for being wrong in good faith as to what the questions were about standing or walking. Thank you.
Thanks to both counsel. The case will be taken under advisement.